Additional English test. Practice test. Listening test. This test has three parts. In each part, you'll hear a number of different extracts. At the start of each extract, you'll hear this sound. You'll have time to read the questions before you hear each extract, and you'll hear each extract once only. Complete your answers as you listen. At the end of the test, you'll have 2 minutes to check your answers. Part A. In this part of the test, you'll hear two different extracts. In each extract, a health professional is talking to a patient. For questions 1 to 24, complete the notes with information you hear. Now look at the notes for extract 1. Extract 1, questions 1 to 12. For questions 1 to 12, complete the notes with a word or short phrase. You now have 30 seconds to look at the notes.
It's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
And we have already gone through your history and physical. We decided that you are a good candidate for doing the malleolar fixation.
Yes.
SI joint fixation. That
yes.
should help you a great deal. That you don't need the fusion. And that we don't need to do a piriformis release. So I think we're ready then to go ahead and proceed with that if you're ready.
Okay, well, I have done a little bit of studying upon mm-hmm. this. And I've got some questions. I wrote some questions down. And I would like you to... If you could explain the surgery to me, exactly what I will be going through and what you'll be doing to me.
Sure. The first thing that we're going to do is the morning of the surgery, you're going to go to the preoperative area.
Mm-hmm.
And in the preoperative area, Vicki comes in the morning of the surgery as well as I do too, of course. But she is going to manipulate you and make sure that you feel good and that you're in alignment, in good alignment. Then you're going to be taken to the surgery suite itself. And you'll be on the gurney in the surgery suite, and we will put you to sleep there.
Mm-hmm.
You also get IV antibiotics at that time, and at that time they'll set you up for the neuromuscular monitoring. They'll put little needles, and they are little,
okay.
And of course, and you're asleep also anyway, but they'll put small needles in all the muscles so that during the surgery we can monitor that to make sure we're not near a nerve root. And then after that, we will roll you into a prone position. The surgery is done with you on your stomach, so you'll be on chest rolls. Then we're ready. And then we'll go ahead and prep your back and proceed with surgery. Now, you're having a fixation only, and what we will end up doing is putting two screws on each side. And the way that I determine where to put the screw in is first with an 18-gauge needle and then under the C-arm. I didn't mention earlier, of course, we have you on position so that we can use C-arm, which is for x-rays, or for fluoroscopy, so that we can look through and see the bones. We'll stimulate the pin, and then we'll see if we get a response from the muscles. And if we do not get a response, we stimulate up to 20 milliamp level. If we do not get a response at about 50 milliamp level, we're usually very happy with that, even if we get a little response later on. But that makes sure that we're not close to the nerve roots, which are down here. Now, after we have the pin and the pin, we're happy with that, with the positioning on x-ray, as well as with the lack of response on the stimulation. Then we'll get a screw, a titanium cannulate screw, and put that over that guide pin, and then literally put it into the bone, screw it into the bone,
okay.
and compress it. So, and then after we have the screw in, and usually I use 35 millimeter length screws most of the time. After we have the screw in, we'll test it again by stimulation to see mm-hmm. if there's response from the muscles. And again, if there isn't, then we're happy with that. And then that's the finish, the first
one. Do you ever have to reposition a pin or
we
move
do.
A pin out?
Sometimes if we start getting response about 10 milliamps or below that, we're certainly going to reposition
okay.
it. So we're happy with the first one. And then we put in a second one, which is essentially parallel, usually a little bit higher, pretty much parallel to the first one. And that's actually the end of the procedure.
Well, now, after this, how long am I going to be in the hospital?
You'll be in the hospital if you're local, we'll keep you overnight.
Okay. Okay. Now, what about my short-term restrictions right after surgery?
In the immediate period after the surgery now, we are going to limit your activity. We do want you to be active. We do want you to walk.
Okay.
But we want you to limit the prolonged standing or limit the prolonged walking to about 30 minutes.
Can you go up in that all or like once a day?
You can. Okay. You can. You really will let you do what you really need to do.
Okay.
But just kind of be careful in doing it.
Okay.
The other thing we want you to not do is do any repetitive bending over, repetitive extending,
okay,
which is really similar to most back problems.
Now, what about my long-term restrictions?
Long-term, as we talked about before, no bungee jumping.
I promise not to.
Okay. And then, but more significantly, even you don't want to do things that are going to be jarring to the back. Specifically, even stair climbing or the stair, not stair climbing, but the stair master type of aerobic exercises. It would not do that. I think swimming would be much better.
What about yoga? Because I've done yoga for years.
Yoga, if you avoid the extremes of it, you can do the yoga.
I don't do the extremes of it. My body won't do the extremes of it. What about, I was curious about the screws. Do they ever work their way out?
No, they don't. There is a possibility they could possibly become loose, but really we've not had that problem either. The screws are made of titanium, and the titanium really attracts the bone to grow right up to it, much more so than stainless steel. So they're not going to work their way out on their own.
Now, is there a difference between a fixation and a fusion?
There is a difference. You're just going to have the fixation.
Okay. And that's good. That's good to know.
So these are really two different things.
Now, the other thing, when you fix the joint, which it's not moving anymore, do I lose any motion, or is my body going to be able to tell that?
Of course, the whole idea of this whole procedure is to limit what I call micromotion, which in this case you always are supposed to have a little micromotion in that joint. But if you have excessive motion, it leads to the problems like you have. So we are limiting that motion. We are twisting.
So
it's
I can
not
continue on what afterwards.
You can continue. Actually, do a lot better because it's not going to hurt.
Exactly. That is true. That's true. Now, speaking of pain, what about post-op pain? How much pain is involved with this?
You are going to have some discomfort, especially in the immediate post-op, but it is a different, it's a post-operative pain. It's not the same pain as what you had beforehand.
Okay.
And usually is not that severe that you cannot get up on the morning or on the afternoon after the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
We usually do these surgeries first thing in the morning so that, and then by the afternoon, usually we try to get you up with physical therapy. And most everyone responds that most of their preoperative pain is gone, if not all of it. But they still have some of the postoperative pain, but it's much more tolerable for them than the preoperative pain was. And, of course, that's going to lessen. Even by the next morning, that's markedly lessened.
I am ready to have this surgery. You've answered my questions, and I think let's just go for it because I am very ready.
That sounds good.
Extract 2. Questions 13 to 24. For questions 13 to 24, complete the notes with a word or short phrase. You now have 30 seconds to look at the notes.
Good morning, I suppose you're George?
Yes, yes, and I believe you're Dr. Mark?
Oh, yes, I am. What brings you here today?
Well, I'm having this redness in my, in the white part of my eye, actually.
All right.
I think, I don't know what it's called. Is it called the conjunctiva or something? Mm-hmm. It's quite swollen, and, you know.
I see that.
I've been having more tears than usual. More than tears, I think it's, sometimes I can feel that it's sort of like a yellow kind of discharge. It crusts over the eyelashes, when I go to sleep, it's not, during the daytime, it's not really bad, but when I go to sleep and I wake up, you can see that, it's quite thick.
Do you have any particular sensations there?
It's quite itchy, and I feel sometimes burning, mm-hmm. In the eyes, and I'm not sure it's because of these discharges or whether anything else is happening. I feel like my vision is quite blurred. I believe the sensitivity to the light has changed as well. How do I call it? It's like stubby.
Stubby.
Don't have anything else, just these things, and I have other allergies and everything, but I don't know whether this is associated with it.
All right, allergies, you said.
Yeah. I'm allergic to pollen.
Dust.
Not very much. It's hard to. I mean, pollen is, it's tested, and I am positively allergic to pollen,
okay.
And sometimes I get common cold and mm-hmm. Not a lot. So I would love you to do probably an eye examination, mm-hmm. and
There is a thorough history collection in the laboratory.
So I believe I'm gonna have to give some blood or something like that.
No, you don't have to.
Yeah.
You could rest assured.
Yeah.
Always do keep the eyes clean, please.
Yeah. I'm pretty I've had it when I was a child, and I remember I washed my washed the eyes with clean water, and I changed the pillowcases every day, morning. And I have to do until the infection goes away, but it's not my expertise. It's more of your expertise. So, I do the basic do's and don'ts, and I don't touch both eyes or with the same finger. I don't rub. I don't want to spread it to the other eye as well. So, and hopefully, last time when it happened. The doctor gave me some eye drops, and it's just the regular things, I believe. But I feel like I'm a bit of a fraud coming in just for a bit. It might be something silly, but
you did the right thing. So I would ask you not to put a patch over the eye.
Yeah.
It might worsen the infection.
Yeah.
And protect the eyes from dirt.
Yeah.
Especially from the irritants you mentioned.
And
did I forget to ask you to take enough rest?
Well, I've not been doing much. I started off using, on the first day, when it happened, I thought, I'll just, look at it, and I don't want this to go bad or something. So I used an over-the-counter eye drop. I tried it to start with. My vision is a bit blurry, so I'm not, watching TV or anything. I'm just get a bit of rest.
I'd also ask you to stay away from work for a few days, if it's okay.
Well, that's not really a bad thing. If you're happy to give me a sick certificate. I'm physically feeling really good, actually, but it's just, I don't think it's safe as well. I work, in a chemist as well. I mean, I'm not a pharmacist, actually. I just, just read scripts and things and assist a pharmacist. So I don't think it's safe enough with this condition. I should work, so
To that, I'll prescribe you some antihistamines as well.
Yeah. So I think that'll be good. I'll probably take some rest and, you know, take the medications. And do you want me to see me next week, or just you want to know how it goes, or like?
How about in 4 days?
Okay, cool. So I'll try it, and you can, if I can work it out, I'll do it. Great. Thanks. Thank nice you. Meeting you, Doc.
All right. Cool. See ya.
That is the end of part A. Now look at part B.
That is the end of part A. Now look at part B. Part B. In this part of the test, you'll hear 6 different extracts. In each extract, you'll hear people talking in a different healthcare setting. For questions 25 to 30, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. You'll have time to read each question before you listen. Complete your answers as you listen. Now look at question 25. Now read the question.
A thyroid scan provides information about your thyroid size, shape, and position. During a thyroid scan, a radioactive material called a radiotracer is swallowed and is absorbed by your body. It travels through the area being examined and gives off energy in the form of gamma rays, which are detected by a special camera and computer to create images of your thyroid. A thyroid scan tests your thyroid's function. It measures how much radioactive iodine is taken up by your thyroid in a given period of time. You will be given the radioactive iodine in liquid or capsule form. During the exam, you will sit in a chair and a probe will be positioned over your thyroid while a scanner moves over your neck. To prepare for these tests, you may be asked not to eat or drink anything and to refrain from taking certain medications beforehand. Leave any jewelry at home and wear loose, comfortable clothing. You may be asked to wear a gown. Tell your doctor if there's any possibility you are pregnant or if you're breastfeeding. Discuss any recent illnesses or other medical conditions, medications you're taking, and whether you have any allergies. Also, tell your doctor if you've had any procedures within the last 2 months that used iodine-based contrast material. You may have some concerns about thyroid scan and uptake. However, because the amount of radiotracer used is small, the level of radiation exposure is relatively low, and the benefit of an accurate diagnosis far outweighs any risk.
Question 26. Now read the question.
At a hospital discharge meeting, the patient would meet with the nurse, the physiotherapist, and the pharmacist on the ward. The nurse would go through all the information the patient would need to go home, and often relatives are invited to come along and to listen to the information as well. The nurse would talk about managing wounds at home, looking after the wounds, making sure they remain clean and dry, and looking out for signs of infection, for example redness or swelling, or if the wounds become oozy. And if anything of those happens, the nurse would advise the patient to go and see their GP straight away. The nurse would also talk about the rehabilitation process and would include information about dietary concerns, exercise, and smoking cessation if the patient is still smoking. The physiotherapist would talk about exercises the patient needs to do following the surgery. It's really important for the patients to get up and mobilise around, and the physiotherapist would give some exercises for the patient to do every day. And really encourage the patient to walk as much as possible and build up the walking time each day with their relatives. The pharmacist would talk about the tablets that the patient's going to be on following their surgery. Often the tablets change whilst the patient's in surgery, and the pharmacist would talk about the tablets, explain the side effects, any issues related to those tablets, and would explain when to take the tablets as well. And those tablets normally would be reviewed in the outpatient clinic post-cardiac surgery to see if they are still needed.
Question 27. Now read the question.
Today I'm going to be talking about a BiAMP overhead paging system along with a Rauhlenborg nurse call system and the power of connecting those two together. We can automate code blue processes so that when a code blue is pressed, it can automate a response overhead to the paging system, which I'll demonstrate right now.
Attention, code blue, room 501. Medical ICU.
Okay, now the power of this is that, like it said, medical ICU right there, we can add any suffix we want onto that and give clear delineation on where the code blue is coming from and where the staff needs to go to respond to that code. I can make it repeat. We can add different preambles, as you heard a preamble before that. It is really a powerful tool, and I'd love to talk to you about it.
Question 28. Now read the question.
Today I am answering a question about preschool stuttering. So how long do we wait? Well, Mark Onslow of the Australian Stuttering Research Center recommends that a speech therapist should monitor a child for signs of natural recovery for about 6 months, but no longer. So that's his recommendation. He also explains that there are other reasons that you may want to begin therapy sooner, and that would be if the child becomes distressed about the stuttering, you want to go ahead and address it at that point because psychological damage could start to happen. Also, if the stuttering is causing social problems or psychological issues. So if it's interfering with social interactions or any of that kind of stuff, you definitely want to go ahead and address it sooner than that 6 months. So That being said, what do we do? How do we go about fixing stuttering in preschoolers? Well, although there have been many different types of stuttering therapy over the years, there was a systematic review in 2006 by Booth and all of his or her associates. I can't remember if that's a woman or a man. And that study found that the response contingency approach was the most effective treatment for children who stutter. So if you would like to find out more about the response contingency approach, you can click on this link down here. It should be in the show notes right below this video. It's speechandlanguagekids.com/stop-stuttering-preschoolers-current-research-based-methods with dashes in between all of that. So just go down there and click the link. And that will take you to my page all about response contingency stuttering therapy. There's a video that explains it and demonstrates it. So head on over there and check that out. If you have any further questions, please leave those below and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Thanks so much and have a great day.
Question 29. Now read the question.
First and foremost, I think 20 is the new 25. When we studied glaucoma in school, most people were under the impression that 25 millimeters of mercury was the high end of normal. We found that recently, at 20 millimeters of mercury, the intraocular pressure is elevated enough to be adequate, but at 25, it's really starting to affect exoplasmic flow on the optic nerve. So really aim for a pressure of 20 in your veterinary patients. Other things that are new in the realm of glaucoma in pets include the realm of neuroprotection, so medications like memantine, timolol, bimatoprost, and minocycline, which may actually protect the nerve and the nerve function. We are starting to look at glaucoma as more of a neurodegenerative disease, so not only a disease of the eye, but also a disease of the brain, and it can actually be affected by systolic blood pressure as well as intracranial pressure.
Question 30. Now read the question.
The goal of this paper, this health policy statement, is to give a uniform document where all laboratories can find the information they need and utilize that information to communicate in all aspects of healthcare to improve patient quality. I've had the experience over my career through SCAI, working on the quality committee, through the accreditation committee in ACE, and through lab surveys committees, to see there's significant variation in all laboratories with amongst multiple laboratories about the catheterization lab. Some using PROS, some using documentation, some multiple entries for billing and inventory and databases, and every different entry has the potential of an error. The goal of this report is to take that potential error out of it and improve patient quality. The emphasis that we had throughout this effort was to make this as uniform for the laboratories, for the vendors, for all to make it easy to transfer data, to make it non-repetitive, and have a uniformity across all fields.
That is the end of Part B. Now look at Part C. Part C. In this part of the test, you'll hear two different extracts. In each extract, you'll hear health professionals talking about aspects of their work. For questions 31 to 42, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. Complete your answers as you listen. Now look at Extract 1. Extract 1, questions 31 to 36. You now have 90 seconds to read questions 31 to 36.
Sophie, I thought this article was really fascinating, not least because after years, maybe decades of debate on the downsides of medicine and overdiagnosis, it seems quite incredible that we don't quite know what we're talking about still. And you seem to have been working hard to really try and understand and define what too much medicine is. Can you set the scene for us a bit and tell us how you got into this and why it's important to try and define these concepts?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you know, Helen, this paper kind of started with a really interesting experience at the second International Overdiagnosis, well, Preventing Overdiagnosis conference. We all talked about overdiagnosis animatedly for 3 days, and we had a sense of solidarity, and we agreed that this was a problem and it needed to be fixed. And then on the fourth day, there was a special invitation only meeting of experts. So just people that were really engaged with research about overdiagnosis to try and set the research agenda for the next 12 months. And the very first session was called, I think, Nailing Down the Definition of Overdiagnosis. And there was 2 hours devoted to this session. And so these are all people who've been thinking about overdiagnosis a lot. And it became apparent within the first 15 minutes that there was no way that we were going to nail down the definition of overdiagnosis that day, because everyone was using the word in a slightly different way. So we all had this general shared intuitive sense that we were all interested in the same problem or similar problems or related problems, but we weren't completely clear what we meant when we said this word, overdiagnosis. So we came away from that meeting really motivated to try to unpack why that could be, why these very well-intentioned, very smart, expert people were not using this word in exactly the same way.
And why is it important to have clarity on that word? What's it stopping us doing, or what conversations can't we have without its definition?
I think overdiagnosis is such a difficult thing to approach in policy terms, in clinical terms, and I find it even just talking with my friends about overdiagnosis, it's quite counterintuitive, and it can be very difficult to talk about in a way that convinces people that it is a problem that we need to do something about. I think if we're not clear ourselves what we're talking about, it becomes very difficult for us to be clear with policymakers and with the general public that this is a problem that we need to do something about. And we also, if we're not clear, I think we potentially waste a lot of energy within the research and clinical community talking across purposes. If we're all using the word to mean different things and talking past each other, we waste a lot of energy. But if we can be clearer amongst ourselves what exactly this problem is that we're trying to solve, we've leaped the first hurdle towards trying to solve the problem. And the problem, really, I think the people that are focused on the problem of too much medicine are really mostly concerned that medicine is harming people when it doesn't mean to, and that we're allocating resources in a way that doesn't get the best benefit for the people who need medical care. So it's motivated by good reasons, wanting to prevent harm and wanting to make sure that there's the maximum amount of benefit. But until we're clear exactly on what overdiagnosis is, it's hard to achieve those things that we're trying to achieve.
And what are the key themes that emerge? Because I went to some of your sessions, and you might think walking into the sessions at the conference that overdiagnosis is quite a numerical black and white issue, but actually in the setup of this article you explain that it's actually far more complicated than that, and to an extent overdiagnosis or too much medicine is in the eye of the beholder, and there's a lot of judgment and ethics and messy stuff in there. Tell us a bit about that.
It's true. So part of the challenge of overdiagnosis is that it's a really complicated scientific problem. So there's amazing people, including my colleague Alex Barrett, who you'll be speaking with later, who've dedicated many years of their career to trying to work out how to produce accurate, trustworthy scientific measurement of the size of overdiagnosis. So it's definitely a scientific problem. But we can't reduce it just to some kind of ideal of value-free science where we just get the maths right and then we know how big it is and then we know what to do. And the reason for that is that overdiagnosis is fundamentally about, or too much medicine is fundamentally about, trying to identify the situations in which medicine is doing more harm than good, or medicine is not delivering a net benefit. And as soon as you start talking about harm and benefit, you're in the realm of ethics. You're in the realm of weighing up goods and bads. And as soon as you start talking about harm and benefit, you have to ask, as you said, from whose perspective? So whose ideas about harm and benefit should matter when we weigh up whether to do a particular test or whether to offer a particular drug? Should it be the patient's assessment of benefit and harm, the clinicians, researchers, all of them? If they disagree, how should we adjudicate between them? If there's different benefits and different harms that all have to be weighed up, then how do we do that weighting? So, and that's moral territory, it's ethical territory. So that needs to be a conversation that is quite explicit, and a conversation that brings in citizens, that brings in the public, which is why it's so important to have good public conversations about too much medicine. And if we want to address too much medicine, we also need to recognise that it's a social problem. You know, this is a problem that comes from the social systems that we humans create for ourselves. So it's driven by things like clinicians who are pushed and pulled by incentives and penalties in the systems that they work in, and clinicians who feel threatened by medico-legal threats to do more testing and to make sure that they've covered every base, or companies who are required to make a profit, and so they might sell tests or sell drugs harder than they should to try and make more money, or things like the increasing rise of direct-to-consumer selling of tests, like genomic tests. So, you know, spit in a vial and send it off in the post and you can get information about your genome sent back to you in a couple of weeks. So these social forces are an important part of what creates overdiagnosis, what motivates it, what drives it. So if we're going to be able to address it effectively, we've got to acknowledge and take seriously that social aspect of overdiagnosis or too much medicine. So the science is critical, but the ethical and social dimensions are just as critical, and in fact should feed into the science if it's going to be good science.
So setting out these definitions must have been no easy thing, and it sounds like there's a huge grey zone in terms of how we're going to be able to think and deal with them. In your article, you've got an enormous table, I guess, informed by the opinions of all these different experts who were feeding in their thoughts about what overdiagnosis was. Can you explain for the reader some of the broad things that are in there?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we tried to do was to get to the bottom of a difference, actually, because when we thought about why those well-intentioned, super smart experts in that room couldn't agree on what overdiagnosis was, we concluded that it was possibly because they were using that word at two different levels of generality, so that some of those experts were using the word overdiagnosis in a very specific way to mark out a very specific concept. And we argue in the paper that this is how the word overdiagnosis should be used, that we should start restricting it to a narrow sense. And that sense is really about the boundaries of the definitions of conditions. So the narrow sense of overdiagnosis, which is the first line in our table, is when a person is diagnosed with a condition, but that diagnosis doesn't produce a benefit for that person. So it's a very particular problem, and it's about rethinking the boundaries of diagnostic categories, and thinking about those boundaries not in terms of can we make sure that we find every case, or can we make sure that we treat every person, or can we leave no stone unturned, but instead it's about thinking what will the benefits be, what will the harms be, how can we weigh them up against each other, how can we be sure that the benefits are likely to outweigh the harms. So that concept of overdiagnosis is quite narrow, quite specific. And it really needs to be, yeah, it is. It's about when is it a good thing to label this person? So when is it likely to benefit this person to give them this label? And it really has to be negotiated condition by condition, because that decision obviously has to be made in collaboration between the clinicians and the patients and the researchers that are working on that very particular problem. So overdiagnosis in that narrow sense, we're arguing in the paper, should be the only way that we use the word overdiagnosis. And we've adopted the BMJ term too much medicine to encapsulate a whole lot of other problems that are related to but not the same as.
Now look at Extract 2. Extract 2. Questions 37 to 42. You now have 90 seconds to read questions 37 to 42.
Breast cancer is not one single disease, but actually 10 distinct types of tumor, dependent upon a woman's genetic makeup. That is the finding of the largest ever study of breast cancer tissue and could provide more targeted treatment. Our science editor, Tom Clark, is here to tell us more. Tom, it sounds dramatic, 10 different diseases, effectively.
This study is one of the most sort of powerful in recent years to illustrate what new genetic technologies are allowing scientists to do in sort of redefining how they understand disease. And it's a big step towards this idea of tailoring disease treatment to the individual, this idea of personalized medicine, in this case, for breast cancer. Nowadays, today, at diagnosis, how serious a breast tumor is largely judged based on how well how it responds to tests for the two particular breast cancer drugs there are available to treat the disease. And this study sort of turns all that on its head. It looked at 2,000 tumors from women in the UK and in Canada. It's the largest study of its kind. And what it found by looking at thousands of genetic mutations within those tumors is that, yes, breast cancer isn't one disease, but it falls into 10 very discrete genetic groups. And which genetic family the breast cancer belongs to has a strong bearing on how serious that tumor might be and how well it responds to treatment. For example, one class that they've identified, which according to current tests would be grouped as, you know, quite difficult to treat, in fact only has about a 10% mortality rate after 10 years, not such a severe type of cancer. Conversely, another group that they've identified, which would have a sort of fairly positive treatment profile based on current tests, would in fact has a 60% mortality after 10 years, a really nasty type of tumor. More interestingly, another new class that seems to belong to these very lucky group of women whose immune system gets involved and sort of fights their cancer for them, of particular interest to scientists. And as the report's author told us earlier, this should ensure in future that women get the right treatment for their disease.
If it's 10 diseases, it means that they'll require different diagnostic procedures, they will be associated with different clinical outcomes, and they will require different treatments. And so it's a big step forward in terms of how we manage women with breast cancer and how we need to not think of it as one or two or three diseases, but a much more complex entity that will require, therefore, more tailored treatment.
More tailored, so less mastectomy, more mastectomy, less tamoxifen. I mean, how's it going to look?
Dictate how a doctor, the tools the doctor has in his armory to treat cancer, but it will prevent, for example, it will help identify those women who've got a particularly nasty type of tumor and make sure they get the right kind of treatment early on, possibly the more radical types of treatment. But it could also, on the other hand, and just as importantly, spare some women very toxic, very expensive chemotherapy that their tumor might not necessarily need. I should point out that they've identified these 10 groups. It doesn't mean these tests will be available tomorrow. They've got to do clinical trials to prove that what they've seen in this study translates into the hospital environment. But Cancer Research UK, which funded the work, are now immediately they're going to start funding trials to look into this. So there's the chance that women who are newly diagnosed with breast cancer will be able to enroll in those studies. I'll just mention one more thing. Looking at all these, you asked about new tools in the armory. Women, by looking at so many genes in this study, they've identified some quite promising new targets for those for companies to look at to develop new medicines for treating breast cancer.
Tom Clark. Now, a quick summary of tonight's news at 7:29. A Libyan military commander is taking legal action against Jack Straw following allegations the former foreign secretary personally permitted his illegal rendition. Lawyers representing Abdul Hakim Belhaj confirmed legal papers had been served on the MP. Unemployment in Britain has fallen for the first time in almost a year. The jobless total fell by 35,000 in the quarter to February to 2.65 million. The government says the figures were a step in the right direction. And as Breivik, who killed 77 people in a bomb and shooting attack in Norway, told a court that the death penalty or a full acquittal were the only logical outcomes for his massacre. And Home Secretary Theresa May has dismissed terror suspect Abu Qatada's latest bid to avoid deportation as a delaying tactic. His lawyers lodged an appeal with Europe's human rights judges, effectively blocking the government's attempts to deport him to Jordan.
And still to come tonight.
What?
In a moment, cameras are allowed in court for the first time to record the sentencing in a murder trial. Is this the start of a revolution in how we view justice? And at 7:38, inspire a generation. The Olympic motto is unveiled as the 100-day countdown begins.
That is the end of part C.